There are about 12 clotting factors in the blood, and the first of which is factor 1, also called fibrinogen, and this acts as a fibrin precursor. Factor 2 is called prothrombin, and it acts as a thrombin precursor. Factor 3 is called tissue factor or thromboplastin, and it acts as factor 10 activation. Factor 5 is called calcium ion, and it functions as a cofactor in several reactions that occur in the pathway. Factor 5 is called Leber factor or proacelerin, and it acts as a cofactor in activating factor 2. Factor 7, proconvertin, activates factor 10. Factor 8, called antihemophilic factor A or globulin, activates factor 10 as well. Factor 9, called antihemophilic factor B or Christmas factor, forms thrombin, that is, it helps in thrombin formation. Factor 10, called stout proral factor, also acts in thrombin formation. Factor 11, called PTA, that is plasma thromboplastin antecedent, also helps in factor 9 activation. Factor 12, Hegemann factor, acts as a protease zymogen. And finally, factor 13, called transglutaminase or fibrin stabilizing factor, function as a zymogen of transglutaminase. So these are all the clotting factors and what they perform. The change of blood from its liquid state to a gelatinous mass is termed coagulation. So, blood clotting or blood coagulation simply refers to as the clotting or the thickening of the blood. Okay? Thrombosis is the formation of blood clots inside a blood vessel, and this obstructs the flow of blood in the circulatory system. And it gets to a point where the clot gets loose, like it breaks free and then circulates around the whole body system. At that point in time, it's then called an embolus. Okay, there are three different types of the thrombi. Okay, and each of these thrombi contains fibrin, but they are all different. We have the white thrombus, the red thrombus, and the disseminated fibrin deposits. White thrombus is composed of platelets and fibrin, and it is very poor in electrolyte, that is, it has low amount of red blood cells. Okay, and it occurs especially in areas of blood vessels where blood flow is very rapid, like the arteries. Red thrombus contains primarily red cells and fibrin, and it kind of resembles the kind of clot that occurs during a test tube, okay, and it occurs in areas of slow blood flow, that is, in the veins, that's where red thrombus can be found. Then disseminated fibrin deposits, well, from the name fibrin, it contains fibrin, and it occurs in very small blood vessels like the capillaries. Hemostasis, that is hemostasis, okay, refers to as the cessation or the stopping of bleeding that occurs from a cut or a severe blood vessel. And there are processes, there are three major processes, okay, that leads to this hemostasis. and we have one. The first process is that the platelets, they become activated by thrombin, and they then aggregate at the site of injury, clinging to one another. Okay, the second one is that these activated platelets then release a substance called thrombaxin, A2, that is a potent vasoconstrictor. And we know what a vasoconstrictor does. It will induces blood vessel constriction. Thus, it will minimize blood flow from going to that injured blood vessel. Okay. Then the third process to stimulate hemostasis is the combined action. Okay, the combined action of the vasoconstriction and platelet aggregation will result in the formation of platelet plug. And this is platelet plug that in major cases stop the bleeding. Okay, so with this being said, we can then quickly look into fibrin clot formation and how, and also the other pathways through which blood clot formation occurs. So guys, let's get started. So guys, you know, at the beginning we gave a brief intro into what blood clotting refers to and how hemostasis came about. So those are just a bird's eye view of everything we're going to be looking into today. So what we're going to dive into now is going to be the pathway aspect of how blood clotting came about. So get your pen and your papers ready. So there are two pathways, okay, that can initiate blood clotting, and they are the extrinsic pathway and the intrinsic pathways. And both of these pathways will eventually converge or combine to then form a common pathway. And it is this common pathway that will then result in fibrin formation, that is the coagulation itself. So guys, and the common pathway just involves activation of prothrombin to thrombin, and then thrombin then converts to fibrinogen, the fibrinogen then form the fibrin clot itself. So that is how we're going to flow today. So we'll be starting with the extrinsic pathway. So guys, there are some brief points you need to note about the extrinsic pathway because it's different from the intrinsic pathway. Now, extrinsic pathway is induced by, okay, one of the properties of the extrinsic pathway is that it occurs between 10 to 12 seconds, while the intrinsic pathway requires several minutes to form up, okay? The extrinsic pathway is induced when vascular injury occurs, that is when the tissue factor is exposed. Okay, that is when extrinsic factor comes to work, and this is kind of the most clinically relevant pathway because it occurs under normal physiological condition. That is the extrinsic pathway. It occurs upon release of the tissue factor due to tissue injury, whereas the intrinsic pathway only occurs when there is contact between the blood and negatively charged surfaces. I don't know if all this makes any sense, but without beating further into the bush, let's just explain what involves in the extrinsic pathway. So guys, all the A's I'll be mentioning in these steps just simply means activated is a short form. So here is the steps involved in extrinsic pathway. Number one, upon damage of endothelial cells of the blood vessel, a protein called tissue factor is released. 2. This tissue factor then interacts with and activates factor 7, that is proconvertin, into factor 7a. This tissue factor also acts as a cofactor for factor 7a in activating factor 10, that is, starts proval factor into factor 10a. 3. 10a then activates factor 2 into factor 2a, okay, which in turn activates factor 8 into factor 8a. And it is factor 8a that continues the normal formation of factor 10 into 10a. So, it is this 10a, that is factor X, it is the site where the intrinsic and the extrinsic then combine. So, 10a is the beginning of the common pathway. I hope this really makes much sense. So the steps that are involved in the intrinsic pathway are as follows. First, it starts with a contact phase where a protein as well in the blood, prekallikrein, okay, where prekallikrein factor 12 and factor 11 are all exposed to a negatively charged surface. 2. Upon proteolysis of prekallikrein, okay, factor 12 is activated to factor 12a. 3. Factor 12a then activates factor 11 into factor 11a and then releases bradykinin. 4. Factor 11a in the presence of calcium ion activates factor 9 into factor 9a, which in turn cleaves factor 10 into 10a. And again, this 10a is where intrinsic and extrinsic combine to form the common pathway. So 10a is the beginning of the common pathway. So the steps involved in the common pathway includes 1. Factor 10a activated either by the intrinsic or the extrinsic pathway activates prothrombin into thrombin, that is factor 2 into 2a. And it does this in the presence of calcium ion, phospholipids, factor 5a, and prothrombin. 2. Thrombin then catalyzes the conversion of factor 1 into fibrin. 3. Thrombin also converts factor 8 into 8a, and this conversion is very important in stabilizing fibrin hard clots. So these are the processes involved in the common pathway. So guys, if probably you are asked in the exam to describe the blood clotting pathway that will lead to the formation of fibrin hard clot, I will suggest, okay, with the aid of a diagram first, then you explain these three steps, that is the steps involved in intrinsic pathway, extrinsic pathway, and the common pathway, and you'll be assured of your marks. So just take it slowly and absorb the info, okay? Vitamin K play a very important role in blood clotting in animals, and its absence can actually lead to severe conditions and even impair blood clotting formation. So factors 2, 7, 9 and 10 requires vitamin K for their functioning, all because of the calcium ion binding properties of GLA residue, that is carboxyl glutamate residue. So if peradventure vitamin K is absent, there will be impaired blood clotting, because all these factors, clotting factors, require vitamin K for the normal function in coagulation pathway. And there are some factors that could lead to vitamin K deficiency, and they include fat malabsorption, sterilization of the large intestine with antibiotics, biliary diseases, pancreatic dysfunction, to mention but a few. So that is it. So the process of fibrinolysis, from the word lysis, breakdown, is just the enzymatic dissolution of fibrin heart clots. Okay, that is after the whole blood clotting process has formed, fibrinolysis will come into play to then break down these clots for proper healing of the wound. You understand? So, and the enzyme that is responsible for this breakdown is plasmin. And plasmin is secreted in its inactive form called plasminogen, because if it is in its active form, it will quickly be inactivated by its inhibitor. Anyways, following injury, the endothelial cells release tissue plasminogen activator, which binds to fibrin, okay, and then cleaves plasminogen within the clot and generates plasmin, which in turn digests fibrin to form soluble degradable products and thus dissolves the clot. So, anticoagulants are drugs, substances that are used to prevent clotting of blood, especially when it is not under hemostasis, or when they don't occur under the normal physiology of the body, that is, when there is kind of a problem within the blood vessels and unnecessarily clotting appears, anticoagulants comes into play. And this is where they have a therapeutic advantage, okay? That is, in conditions of pulmonary embolism, deep vein thrombosis, atrial fibrillations, congestive heart failure, stroke, myocardial infarction, genetic or hereditary hypercoagulopathy. So all these are problems where anticoagulants are used, okay, in the body to solve. And the way they work is that they bind calcium ions. And we all know what calcium ion does from the beginning. We said calcium ions, they act as a cofactor for several reactions that will occur in the coagulation pathway. So imagine it binding with calcium ion. It will prevent all these factors, okay, from binding with it. And they are classified based on how they work. We have one, the calcium inhibitors. These anticoagulants are the ones that directly inhibit calcium, and they include citrates, oxalates, EDTA. And there's another, there are a group of anticoagulants that inhibit thrombin directly, and they are hirudin, lepirudin, bivalirudin. There is also a class of anticoagulants that indirectly inhibit thrombin, and they are called heparin. We also have another class that inhibits factor 10A, and they are rivaroxaban and apixaban. And finally, we have the anticoagulants that antagonize vitamin K, and they are coumarins and warfarins. So that is all about anticoagulants and how they work. And it's not everything that are going to be used inside the body. Like, majority of them are going to be used outside the body. Okay, so let's just quickly move on to the next segment, which is interpretation of blood coagulation test. And there are some few terms by chemists or lab scientists use when testing blood, and they are the bleeding time, prothrombin time, and partial thromboplastin time. So the bleeding time is just the time taken for bleeding to stop, and it is done through the IV method or the Duke method. And there are some disorders that are associated with increased bleeding time, and they include intravascular coagulopathy, thrombocytopenia, liver diseases, leukemia, bone marrow failure. The second term is the prothrombin time, okay? And the purpose of this is just to evaluate the extrinsic pathway, okay, of blood coagulation. And some of the common factors they examine are fibrinogen, prothrombin, factors 5, 7, and 10. And the deficiency of any of these factors will lead to a prolonged prothrombin time. The final one is partial thromboplastin time, and this one evaluates the defects in the intrinsic pathway. It looks into factors like fibrinogen, prothrombin, factors 5, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, and a defect or a deficiency in any of these factors will prolong partial thromboplastin time. And there are some diseases associated with this, which include vitamin K deficiency, Willebrand diseases, hemophilia, to mention but a few. Hemophilia A is a hereditary bleeding disorder due to genetically deficiency of factor 8, and patients that suffers from hemophilia, they have impaired blood clotting, and it is because of genetics, like I made mention of earlier, an X chromosome linked disease that occurs in males and in homozygous females due to X inactivation. So maybe due to certain gene deletion in these chromosome arrangements, hemophilia A occurs, whereas hemophilia B is also a X chromosome linked disease with deficiency of factor 9 gene, and it is caused by a mutation, okay, by mutation of factor 9 gene, and it's sometimes called Christmas factor, okay, and it has some clinical resemblance with hemophilia A, just that hemophilia B is caused by mutation. So with that being said, let's then look into blood plasma and serum proteins. So plasma proteins are obtained from a non-coagulated blood, while serum proteins are obtained from a coagulated blood. Plasma proteins play important roles in transport, for example, in transport of essential metabolites like lipids, in transport of hormones like cortisol and thyroxine, in transport of metals like copper and iron, in transport of excretory products such as bilirubin, in transport of drugs and other toxic ingested substances. Plasma protein also function in maintaining the colloid osmotic pressure, and this is done by one of its important proteins called albumin. And another function of the plasma protein is its buffering capacity, and this is played by hemoglobin, which is a kind of plasma protein. Another function is defense reaction, that is defense. Another function is coagulation and fibrinolysis. That is many plasma proteins. Like we mentioned earlier, you have seen how proteins involve in coagulation. Another one is other functions, okay? So these are the major functions of plasma proteins by some of its common proteins like albumin, hemoglobin, immunoglobulins, clotting factors, and the likes of it. So now we'll be looking into hemoglobin breakdown and also bilirubin metabolization and jaundice and the likes of it. So hemoglobin breakdown occurs in the reticuloendothelial cells, such as the spleen, liver, and the bone marrows. And hydrolytic enzymes in macrophages degrade red blood cells, that is after the end of their life cycle or the lifespan. Okay, these hydrolytic cells from the macrophages degrade them, releasing hemoglobin. Once this hemoglobin is released, proteolytic digestion or proteolytic enzyme acts on it to further break it down into heme and globins, where globin is further broken down into amino acid and used for future protein production. Heme, that is H-E-M-E, the ion from heme is released, okay, and taken back into circulation, because iron is also important. Leaving heme, okay, you know, once iron is removed from heme, a porphyrin ring will be formed, and it's then converted into bilirubin. Bilirubin, which is a very significant substance in the liver, okay, also is a yellowish pigment that's responsible for bioproduction, and it's very, very significant in the body. And we're going to be looking into how it's metabolized, okay, further, and how it's been taken up by the liver cells. With that being said, let's get started. Now, bilirubin metabolism or processing occurs in the liver cells before it is then finally stored in the bile, all because at this point in time bilirubin is non-conjugated, and secretion of non-conjugated bilirubin into the blood cells is very, very toxic. That's why the liver has to act on it through three different phases, and one is the uptake of bilirubin by the liver parenchyma cells. 2, conjugation of bilirubin in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, and 3, secretion of conjugated bilirubin into the bile. So you've seen the picture already. So let's get going. So remember we said bilirubin cannot circulate freely in the blood cells. Okay, then it then binds to albumin. Remember albumin, that protein, okay, before it's then transported into the liver safely. So in the liver cells, albumin then back off, remaining bilirubin. And bilirubin is then taken up by the sinusoidal surface of the hepatocyte. So just the hepatocyte just takes up the bilirubin and acts on it. And it converts bilirubin to a polar form. Since bilirubin on its own is not polar and is not conjugated, you understand? And the way the liver does it is that it adds glucuronic acid to the liver, to bilirubin, to make it polar. So this process is called conjugation, okay? And then the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, it has an enzyme called glucuronosyl transferase, and it acts on this bilirubin, that is after the conjugation, you understand, to convert it to bilirubin mono glucuronide, though it's an intermediate, but that monoglucuronide is an incomplete version of bilirubin, so it's going to be inactive in the body cells before it is then converted again to diglucuronide. Okay, and this most of the bilirubin from the liver cells is then excreted as bilirubin diglucuronide, and this is what is then being stored in the bowel. You understand? And then you are going to be looking at some disorders that happens when, what if the liver cells just give out bilirubin as monoglucuronide, and what happens? And that is when you see something like obstructive jaundice and the likes of it. So bilirubin is then finally stored as bilirubin diglucuronide in the bile. Do you understand? Okay, so let's quickly look into the post-hepatic bilirubin catabolism, that is, what next after bilirubin is catabolized or metabolized in the liver cell, what happens after it? So guys, if you could remember one of the function of bile, okay, let's say bilirubin on its own now, because bile secretes bilirubin, you know, it's on fat catabolism, it's very essential, and the intestines, okay, act on it. So with this picture laid, let's continue. So intestinal bacteria, okay, reduces bilirubin to urobilinogen, which is a colorless tetrapyrolic compound, okay? And some of this urobilinogen is absorbed into general circulation and then excreted through urine, and this is what gives the urine its amber color. So specifically at the ileum and the large intestine, most of the urobilinogens, they are metabolized to stercobilinogens, which is then finally oxidized to stercobilin. And this stercobilin gives the feces their characteristic brown orange color. And in a situation where delivery of bile to the intestine is blocked, urobilinogen will not be formed and stercobilin will not be produced. Then these two, that is the color of the feces, will then appear chalky gray, that is alcoholic stool, and this is a major sign, or this will give you a sign of biliary obstruction. You know guys, in every good thing there's always a bad, that is when hemostasis comes into place to just bring a balance in the body system, because too much of everything could be really bad and less of everything could be bad. And sometimes excessive bilirubin in the blood can really do a lot of damage in the body cells, apart from being able to help fat to be absorbed by the blood cells. Excess of it could lead to so many things, or so many disorders in the body, like jaundice. Okay, so the excess of bilirubin in the blood cell is called hyperbilirubinemia, and this is when the blood contains excessive amounts of bilirubin. And one of the obvious signs you see is that the sclera of the eyes and the skin appears to be yellowish in color, and some of the causes could be that the production of more bilirubin, like liver, there is more production of bilirubin than the liver cells can take, or failure of the damaged liver cell to excrete bilirubin produced in normal amount. And in absence of hepatic injury or in absence of liver cells damage, obstruction of the excretory duct of the liver could cause hyperbilirubin as well. And we have said it already that in condition of hyperbilirubinemia, bilirubin is deposited into tissues and the skin, and the skin and the sclera appears yellowish in color, and the whole disorder is termed jaundice or icterus. With that being said, let's quickly look into hepatic jaundice, and there are two types. You have the post-hepatic jaundice and the pre-hepatic jaundice. Now, the post-hepatic jaundice, you can also call it conjugated hyperbilirubinemia, because of the whole process. And what happens here is that there's blockage of the hepatic duct or the common bile duct that excretes conjugated bilirubin, that is bilirubin diglucuronide, into the bile. You understand? So failure of its excretion will lead to its regurgitation into the hepatic veins and lymphatics. Okay. And once they are found in the veins and the lymphatics, they begin to appear in the blood and the urine, and you would term it choleric jaundice. And if you could remember, this bilirubin is very essential in fat metabolization in the intestines. And we said that in the intestines, it is converted to urobilinogen, and it is this urobilinogen that converts it to stercobilinogen. And this stercobilinogen oxidizes finally into stercobilin, and stercobilin is what gives the feces its characteristic brown chalk. So what I'm trying to insinuate is that failure of bilirubin, conjugated bilirubin into the intestine will lead to a decreased formation of urobilinogen, and this is what will lead to the feces of an individual appear or of an animal appearing gray chalk in color. Do you understand? Okay, so let's look into what prehepatic jaundice means. So guys, we're in the final segment and we're going to be looking into the different disorders of bilirubin metabolism. And the first one we're going to be looking into is hemolytic anemia. And this could arise from anything that could lead to an increased rate of hemolysis, like we discussed earlier. So in this condition, the liver cannot handle the excess of bilirubin being produced from hemolysis. So the resulting condition is unconjugated bilirubinemia. Okay, so the second disorder of bilirubin metabolism we're going to be looking into is neonatal physiological jaundice. And this also results from an acerulated hemolysis, okay? And because of the hepatic system of a newborn is immature, like that is not well developed, okay, for the uptake, conjugation and secretion of bilirubin, there is kernicterus, that is kernicterus. And you know that in this condition bilirubin is unconjugated, and it's only unconjugated bilirubin can penetrate the blood-brain barrier. So in situation of a newborn where the hepatic system is not very matured, and there's increased production of bilirubin, the bilirubin will leak into the blood-brain barrier, causing kernicterus, and this could lead to mental retardation. But there is a way scientists or doctors have found to cure this, and it's through phototherapy, that is exposure of the newborn to blue light, and this will help the liver to convert the bilirubin, okay, that is the excess bilirubin, into other isomers and derivative, okay, that can be eventually excreted and stored in the bowel. The next disorder of bilirubin metabolism we're going to be looking into is Gilbert syndrome, which is an autosomal recessive condition as a result of a decrease in the UDP glucuronosyl transferase enzyme. And if you could remember what we said about this enzyme, okay, it acts on bilirubin, okay, converting it to bilirubin diglucuronide, and that is the major way bilirubin is stored in the bile. So in the absence or in the decrease of this enzyme, okay, bilirubin will not be what's converted finally and stored in that way. So this will eventually lead to jaundice. So Gilbert syndrome leads to jaundice in absence of hemolysis and even any underlying liver diseases. It's a genetic disease due to a decrease in this enzyme we may mention now. Okay, the next disorder of bilirubin metabolism we are going to be looking into is toxic hyperbilirubinemia, which is a bilirubin disorder resulting from toxin-induced liver dysfunction. And some of the toxins that could dysfunction the liver in this aspect include chloroform, carbon tetrachloride, hepatitis virus, cirrhosis, amanitan mushroom poisoning, to mention but a few. So what all these toxins do is that it impairs the ability of the liver to conjugate bilirubin, and this will definitely lead to jaundice. So I hope you quite understood this well. So the next disorder of bilirubin metabolism we're looking into is Crigler-Najjar syndrome type 1, which results from an inherited absence of the enzyme UDP glucuronosyl transferase, okay, in the hepatic tissues. So the absence of that enzyme called UDP glucuronosyl transferase, okay, and this could lead to severe congenital jaundice in newborn, and sometimes it can be really severe that the child or the person can't even survive up to 15 months. So the final disorder we're going to be looking into is the Crigninger syndrome type 2, and just like its counterpart, the type 1, type 2, it's not a complete absence. Instead, it's a part absence of the enzyme UDP, glucuronosyl transferase. Okay, you understand? So it's not as if the enzyme completely disappears or was not even there like type 1. The enzyme is there, but it's incomplete, it's few to say. So because of they have this enzyme, the enzyme actually converts bilirubin into monoglucuronide and not diglucuronide. Okay, so this is where the dysfunction comes into play, because it stops at monoglucuronide, that is, it leaves the bilirubin monoglucuronide. So guys, I hope this is actually simplified in its way, because I try my best possible to break this down in a way that will be understood by you. So just take notes, and if you still find any of them confusing, okay, refer back to your notebooks, your lecture materials, and your good textbooks, and especially YouTube videos as well. Okay, people, we've actually come to the end of blood biochemistry. Yay! I know you must be so excited and proud of yourself that you made it this far. So, guys, much love for me, guys. See you in the other episode, and I wish you all well in the upcoming professional examinations. Bye for now.